Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Muslims and Christians in a turmoil-hit region. We look back at some of the key issues for the Middle East highlighted during Pope Benedict's pastoral visit to Lebanon last weekend. And adult stem cells saved my life. Dying from leukemia 14 years ago, this man's alive to tell his story today thanks to groundbreaking medical treatment using adult stem cells, an ethical treatment supported by the Church. Of Pope Benedict's three-day pastoral visit to Lebanon, during which he made a number of heartfelt appeals for peace in the troubled Middle East area, is continuing to make ripples across the region. Patriarch Ignace Joseph III Yunin is leader of the Syrian Catholic Church of the Antiochian tradition, whose patriarchal see is based in Lebanon. He talked to my colleague Tracy McClure, just ahead of the papal visit, about some of the key issues facing this church, which finds its roots in Syria, where people are currently witnessing one of the darkest chapters in this nation's history.
Until the West likes to call the Arab Spring, Christians were living in Syria relatively in peace. They were respected as a church like others because the regime used to be secular. Of course, we didn't have in this region of the Middle East, except Lebanon, full citizenship as the other of the Muslim majority. However, we can say that after the massacre of 1915, in the Turkish Empire, many Christians who left Turkey came to Syria, to Lebanon, to live relatively in peace and to start a new life. Therefore, we are very, very much concerned about the present situation, not only of Syriac Catholics, but of all Christians in Syria. We are really frightened that another exodus like it, the one we witnessed in Iraq will be starting, and it did start in Syria. And this is for all Christians, even for the Syrian people. It's a really great loss.
The bishops at the Synod for the Middle East called for greater recognition in the Middle East of the contributions of Christians to society, their equal civil rights, freedom of conscience, the importance of nurturing a sense of common citizenship. The Synod, however, ended not long before the Arab Spring erupted. How do you hope this shifting region will respond to this call of the bishops for greater civil rights?
We uphold all rights, civil rights for all. In a democratic country, we have to be beside those who claim their rights of citizenship, the pluralism of political expression, and the freedom of religion and of conscience. Lebanon, it's exception. We have a civilized constitution where citizenship is granted to all, whatever religion or race or ethnic they belong to.
That was Patriarch Ignace Joseph III Yunin speaking to Tracy McClure. Dr. Mohamed Samak is a leading Lebanese Muslim scholar. who is advisor to the Grand Mufti of Lebanon and secretary of the Nation's Committee for Muslim-Christian Dialogue. He is also the author of more than 20 books on Arab affairs, interreligious dialogue and politics and religion, and was one of the guests at the 2010 Synod of Bishops for the Middle East. He spoke to me about why he is a strong supporter of the need for conviviality between Christians and Muslims.
Are you confident that this conviviality between Christians and Muslims in Lebanon can survive, you know, despite all the turmoil one sees going on in the Middle East region?
Well, I don't say that it can survive. I say it should survive and it should play its role in bringing together plural societies into this concept of conviviality, because there is no other way to live together except by accepting and respecting differences, differences of religions, differences of languages, of culture, of ethnicities. God created us different, and God wanted us to be different. And we are going to be different until the end of time. So the only way to deal with these differences is to accept them, respect them, and to live with them.
You have talked in the past about the lack of what you called equal citizenship for Christians in many Middle Eastern countries and what you called the misunderstanding of the spirit of Islamic teachings that lead to negative intellectual and political content, and that the end result of this is that, you know, so many Christians in some Middle East countries are emigrating. Do you still feel that solving these issues is key to keeping Christians in, as you say, this part of the world where they've been for so many centuries?
It's true. Christians are migrating. Big numbers of Christians are migrating, but at the same time, big number of Muslims are migrating for political, economical, and social reasons also. But the Christian migration is really very significant in the sense that it is very dangerous. It is dangerous for Christians. It is dangerous for Christian-Muslim relations because it indicates that Islam does not accept the other, which is not true. And it is the duty of Muslim to prove that it is not true by respecting equality in citizenship, by having civil state. Because according to Islamic teachings, there is no religious state in Islam. Even there is no clergy in Islam. And this means that clergy has no political role. So the only way is to have civil state and equal citizenship by which Christians and Muslims will enjoy their religious freedom and equal duties in front of one law.
And do you find that this is a message that is receptive when you speak to other Muslims in the area, or is it sometimes difficult to get it across?
Well, it is a message accepted by the majority of Muslims. Now, there are extremists who refuse this logic, but it is out of context of Islam, their refusal, because extremism is not part of Islamic teaching, is not part of Islamic doctrine. That's why, because of extremism, it's not only Christians are suffering in the Middle East. We Muslims are suffering too.
As you yourself mentioned earlier, you were one of the three Muslim participants at the Synod of Bishops for the Middle East held in the Vatican in 2010. And you have also been on record as saying that dialogue is your bread and butter. So what have you learnt from Christians during your dialoguing with them that you particularly value?
Well, I learned a lot, let me say, but I learned more by living with my fellow citizens, Christians, in Lebanon and in the Middle East. We live together. It's not theoretically that we make a dialogue. Dialogue is a way of life in my country, in Lebanon. If you just give you a small number that indicates something to you that more than 30% of students in Catholic school are Muslims. So through education, through living together, we can learn from each other, we can live together. And we have many organizations, NGOs and religious organizations that build bridges between our two communities. In Lebanon, it is really, and I'm not exaggerating at all, it is really living together is safe and is a model and is an example to be followed.
I was speaking to Mohammed Samak, Lebanese Muslim scholar and expert on interreligious dialogue. And now my colleague Tracy McClure has this special report on how the use of adult stem cells saved the life of an American man who was dying from leukemia.
He calls himself the Miracle Man, but good science and a lot of good luck may have had more to do with his recovery from leukemia than a true miracle.
A man touched by God and by miracles in more than one.
Stephen Sprague was diagnosed with chronic myelogenous leukemia back in 1995. Doctors tried everything to cure him, including months of chemotherapy. He was on a waiting list for a bone marrow transplant when his disease took a turn for the worse. An only child with no siblings, there were no donors available, and none in the registries matched his type.
I was diagnosed with a chronic kind of leukemia, which they told me, you know, you've got 3 or 4 or 5 years before you really have to start to worry. So I said, okay, I can deal with that. A year and a half after diagnosis, I went from the first stage to the blast crisis stage, the end stage of this process. It took them 6 weeks to get me into remission, and in those 6 weeks, they conducted a bone marrow search. That's all there was. That was the only option for transplant in 1997. In other words,
to find a donor who would give his bone marrow.
Yes, mm-hmm. A live donor who would come and give up his bone marrow for a stranger. And the registry wasn't very big back then, a couple of million maybe. But, you know, you think that somebody's got to be a match for you. This is a big country. But HLA matching, I've learned, HLA is like a fingerprint. And no two are alike. You can get close, but if you have a large mismatch, then the transplant will not be a success.
HLA stands for?
Human leukocyte antigens. And everybody has its own set, and they're different for every person.
And I understand that even within families, even siblings or parents don't necessarily share all of these certain characteristics that are necessary.
Right. Siblings probably have a 30% chance of matching. I was an only child, so, you know, that took care of that. And then there's often or sometimes matches within the family. But you're still left with probably half the patients that need transplant have no related match, so they have to look for an unrelated match. Mm-hmm. The needle in the haystack.
But as Stephen's luck would have it, an unknown woman in New York decided to donate her baby's umbilical cord after birth.
She was at a hospital that had a cord blood collection program. And I'm sure they asked her, would you be willing to donate? Obviously, she said yes. She, to this day, has no idea what she's done. Part of the donation process is that the mother and child remain anonymous.
Because of the anonymous donation process, that woman will never know that thanks to her, Stephen Sprague was completely cured of leukemia and was alive 14 years later to tell his story to participants at a November conference in the Vatican on the therapeutic potential of adult stem cells. That's where I met him.
You said that you received this treatment back in 1997.
Right.
That was the year my son was born.
Really?
And I have to say, I didn't even really know about donating placenta or the cord blood.
No mothers did. This was in the early, early days when only a few mothers, and they had to be in the right city to be able to even do what somebody asked them if they would do. You know, mothers get asked, would you mind if we didn't throw this away and we stored it for use by anybody that needed it? And what mother would say no?
Well, that mother's yes meant Stephen was able to see his kids grow up, marry, and have kids of their own. That mother's donation of cord blood ended up in the laboratories of Dr. Andrew Pecora and his team of researchers at Hackensack University Medical Center in New Jersey, where they were conducting the first clinical trials using cord blood as an alternative source of stem cells to bone marrow. By the fall of 1997, Stephen had been told to get his affairs in order. He had only weeks to live. But again, as luck would have it, he was given his last chance to enroll in Dr. Pecora's clinical trial.
Yes, that's correct. So my background is I'm a bone marrow transplant doctor by training. I'm an oncologist and hematologist, and I treat people with cancer, including leukemia. And Mr. Stephen Sprague, who's now actually world famous because of his life experience, he had a form of leukemia that there was no cure for other than a bone marrow transplant. Unfortunately for him, he was a very large man at the time, and he didn't have a brother or sister. He was an only child. And when we did a donor search through the unrelated donor registry, there were no matches. The only match we could find was an umbilical cord blood, but there were not enough cells in it for a man of Mr. Sprague's size. So we were very fortunate in that we were doing an experimental trial where we were using a new device that hadn't been proven, where we took cord blood, expanded it in a device outside of the body for 14 days, and that grew up enough cells from that umbilical cord blood that we then went forward with the transplant with Mr. Sprague, and the rest is history.
But so few patients can actually get into a trial like that. And he was so grateful to you that you didn't give up on him because he presented so many challenges. He had diabetes. He had a cardiac condition. He was overweight. You have to turn so many people away from these kinds of experiments.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I think it's a matter of the center. I'm very fortunate. I work at the John Thorah Cancer Center in Hackensack, New Jersey. We're a very progressive place. We're a place of innovation. And there are many places like that around the globe where people can seek out this kind of care. To Mr. Sprague's credit, when he was told to go home and put his affairs in order, he was not ready to do that. He had a daughter that he was raising, and he sought us out. So there are places in the world, and I would advise any patient faced with that situation to continue to always explore all of your options.
The state of transplantation at that point was that if you couldn't find the match as a doctor, you watched your patient die. So there were a certain number of doctors who that was not satisfactory. So they started looking at cord blood as a way to find an alternative source of stem cells. But the results in the early days were dismal. So the industry, you know, expecting better results, was not supportive of this new way to transplant a patient. So it took 5 years of dedication from a handful of doctors, several who are here today, to be determined to find an alternative to bone marrow because they didn't want to watch their patients, just have no other option.
And of course, you've been following the research in this field today. What gives you hope for the future?
Well, we know that adult stem cells work. There's been a lot of discussion about embryonic stem cells. They are not in patient application. It's never been tried. It's quite far away from ever being used, and a lot of speculation as to whether it will ever work at all. So here you've got adult stem cells, which have been proven to work for 20 years now. You know, so we're on the cutting edge. For adult stem cell applications, we've already seen 20 years, 12 years of progress. The new applications for stem cells, adult stem cells, is just amazing. You know, it's not going to be surgery. It's going to be stem cell applications to regrow diseased limbs, to deal with diabetes, to deal with heart problems, to deal with all of those diseases that are so horrific.
You have a vademecum of ideas for the future, where all of this should go, what needs to be done in order to make this kind of adult stem cell treatment available in all kinds of health fields for more and more people. How do you think that society, governments, doctors need to tackle this problem?
It's gotten much better. There's probably no transplant center that cannot do a cord blood transplant. There's not enough inventory to match every patient that needs a stem cell transplant. So first of all, the inventory has to be increased. More mothers have to donate. More average citizens need to become bone marrow donors. It costs nothing to be a bone marrow donor. It costs a lot to collect a donated cord blood unit and put it in the freezer. The patient doesn't pay. The mother doesn't pay. The people that pay are the cord blood banks that are working to build a public inventory. They only get recovery when one of their collected units gets selected for transplant. Then they get recovery from insurance. So we have successfully convinced the government to fund...
The United States government.
To fund public cord blood banking. Not a lot of money, $15 million, and it was renewed again after 5 years. So we've got the government engaged in trying to help the financial costs of donating cord blood. But it's nowhere near adequate. So we need the government to find more money. We need to find cost-efficient ways to collect and store. And, you know, the mothers are convinced that they are willing to do this. So that used to be the problem. That's no longer the problem.
You said another thing today, that you could be recognized by this badge you're wearing.
Yes.
Adult stem cells saved my life.
You know, when you're a parent, you watch for your children to grow and marry and family, grandkids. When someone says to you, you're never going to see that. So, you know, prepare. And then all of a sudden, you get it all back. And you see both children marry well to a son-in-law and a daughter-in-law who I like. And you start to see grandchildren. I had my fifth just last year. And, you know, when you are able to give in the gift to watch all this, it is it's hard to describe.
You were sort of given another lease on life, and gave you a new perspective, a new way of looking at life.
Well, you know, I was a busy labor union executive. I thought I had an important job, working for the rights of professional musicians to earn a decent livelihood. And I did that for 20 years. I did it in Times Square. I put in 80 hours a week. I thought I had an important job. I never went back. So when you realize what is important and what true meaning of life is all about, then you decide that you're going to try to be an advocate for the next patient that is going down the path that you went down and try to make it a little easier for them. There were no people like that when I was transplanted. So it is a rewarding day, every day.
What do you think about this Vatican-sponsored conference here?
I've never been to the Vatican. I'm not a Catholic. But first of all, to see the city, the Vatican City, and to see how Catholicism operates, and then to know you have the power of the Pope behind something that really makes a difference to life. It's rewarding, it's encouraging, it's what we need. What the patient community needs is somebody to care about them. They have the medical community, they have the family support. Now they need the religious support to support something that will really have an impact on their life and the life. You know, this is a family disease, so it touches everybody in the family. And that would make a big difference in the quality of life of regular, normal people who get diagnosed with no warning.
Today, Dr. Andrew Pecora is Chief Medical Officer of NeoStem, a U.S.-based biotech company that has partnered with the Pontifical Council for Culture in the promotion of research into adult stem cells. His own research has taken him now into the realm of stem cell treatment for cardiac patients.
There is a significant percentage of people who have heart attacks that are large enough that it doesn't kill them, but it hurts their hearts enough that for the rest of their life, their hearts are going to be a problem. We have developed a stem cell therapy that looks like, out of phase one, now we're going into phase two, that looks like it's able to prevent the heart from being damaged over time from a big heart attack, and we're pretty excited about it.
Where are you sourcing these adult stem cells from?
So they actually come from the bone marrow of the patient who had the heart attack. People who have heart attacks go to their local emergency rooms wherever they are in the world. The standard of care is to open up the blocked artery. Once the blocked artery is opened up, in some countries stents are placed and others not, patients are put on medicines and sent home. About 4 to 5 days after the heart attack, we take patients to a procedure where we take some bone marrow from their hip. It takes about 20 minutes. They don't go to the operating room. They're wide awake. And we send those cells to a laboratory where we pull out a unique cell type that's able, once reinfused in the person's body, to regenerate blood vessels in the area of damaged heart tissue. And the way we give the cells is a cardiologist will place the cells in the coronary artery where the heart attack was caused. The cells are infused. Some 10 to 20 days later, you start to see new blood vessel growth, and 6 months later, the heart is working better instead of getting worse over time, which would otherwise be the case.
Trials like Dr. Pecora's are going on the world over. Researchers using adult stem cells say they have successfully treated vascular disorders in patients who otherwise would have had a leg or an arm amputated. They've successfully regenerated skin tissue that refuses to heal, to treat autoimmune diseases, and even regrow entire organs.
We've been giving stem cells to people for over 50 years in the context of blood and marrow stem cell transplant. Every year around the world, close to 20 to 25,000 people get stem cells infused in their bodies to treat otherwise incurable diseases. Over the last 5 to 7 years, there's been an explosion, first in the knowledge and then in the application, of cells that are either from our own body or from somebody else's. Infused into body parts that are dysfunctioning. So one area is ischemia, where your blood vessels are closing down, either because you're old, you were a smoker, you're a diabetic, or you're just unfortunate. Trauma, where you're in a battlefield or in an auto accident, heart attack, stroke, etc. Another big area is organ dysfunction, and we heard some exciting news where people who have bladders that are damaged from radiation, as an example, who had prostate cancer, they can now regrow bladders. There was a famous case in Europe where a person's trachea was regrown right in the laboratory. So we are entering a new era of medicine, and actually a new era for humanity, where we are going to transform the natural existence we have today of whatever the DNA says, the number of years we're going to live, that's no longer going to be fixed. And in fact, I see in the future people living longer and living longer and healthier by using cells to treat diseases.
And thanks there to Dr. Andrew Pecora, Chief Medical Officer of the biotech company NeoStem. And a warm thanks there also to Stephen Sprague, an advocate of adult stem cell research.
Well, that's all from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English program. But we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And don't forget, you can always find our programs on the internet at www.radiovaticana.va. Laudato Jesus Christus.